This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear how an 800-year-old Muslim cemetery is endangered.
Endangered by guess what? The Museum of Tolerance. Tolerance? Does it make any sense on top of a Muslim cemetery?
John Ehrenberg joins us.
The Iraq Papers, a 656-page book. Nice job. It addresses every aspect of the conflict.
Why is it important now? We're sitting there with worrying about Afghanistan. What's this book?
Stay with us.
Heidi, it's been a few weeks since we followed the case of Luis Posada. Of course, he was a man supposedly responsible. In fact, I think almost everyone thinks for the bombing of a Cuban airliner and killing of well over 70 people. And we, as we know, he snuck into the United States and then he was allowed to walk the streets. And so now that I think there's an update on Luis Posada. He's still living here. He's in his late 80s.
Michael, Posada is actually now 82 years old. He's going to begin trial in El Paso on March 1st. Now,
it's for the bombing of the plane, I hope?
We hope it would be, but it's on relatively minor charges of perjury, obstruction, and naturalization fraud stemming from his 2005 effort to gain legal immigration status after coming to the U.S., where he's been walking the streets of Miami.
He's still out?
He's still out.
This is after he snuck into the United States.
He snuck into the United States, and huge efforts have been made to extradite him to Venezuela, where listeners will remember he escaped prison. Where
he was convicted in Venezuela.
He was convicted.
Of the airline bombing.
Exactly. And that was the 76 bombing, killed, as you mentioned, 73 civilians. He has really walked with impunity in this country. And we've talked about his case in the context of the Cuban Five, because they are serving harsh, in some cases, life sentences. All they did was come to the United States to gather information about terrorist activity in Miami against Cuba. And they gave it to the FBI, and they were arrested with no classified documents for terrorism. So the hypocrisy.
With long sentences. And here you have a guy.
Sentence, and we have a guy now walking in Florida.
Who bombed an airliner.
Bombed an airliner, but is an admitted former CIA agent.
Right.
So there will be huge protests on March 1st.
It's in El Paso
March 1st. Yes. And I know the Committee to Free the Five is organizing a lot of protests. If you go to their website, you can find out how to get involved in this.
Well, it will never be justice because the guy's been walking the streets for a long time since 74. But let's hope they finally convict him and put him in jail. But I'm pretty worried, actually, that that won't happen.
The CIA is doing everything it can to protect this guy. FreeTheFive.org. Check it out.
Terrorism, Michael, has been again in the news. And Sarah Palin apparently drew rousing applause at a recent convention of Tea Party activists when she said, quote, "We need a commander-in-chief, not a professor of law." Then she appeared on Fox News Sunday, continuing her critique of Obama by attacking what she called, quote, "this perceived lackadaisical approach that he has to dealing with the terrorists." What do you say to that?
Well, the question is, what did Obama say to that? You would think Obama might have said, particularly if he knows constitutional law, well, here's what I think. We shouldn't have military commissions. We should prosecute the people who engaged in torture. We should try people in regular courts. We shouldn't have preventive detention scheme. But no, that's not what Obama said. Obama said what a bunch of us on the progressive side have been saying for a long time. The most important thing for the public to understand is we're not handling any of these cases any different than the Bush administration handled them all through 9/11. So now, all of a sudden, our president is wrapping himself in the Bush and so-called anti-terrorism policies. And of course, it just gets worse from there. A couple of days ago, Obama appointed a Marine colonel to be the person in charge at the Pentagon of detainee policy. That's a big job. It had a sort of liberal in there who just resigned abruptly a few months ago. I think Barry Carter was his name. But this guy who they've appointed is William Lightsow, Defense Department. He is a Marine colonel, actually. And what's interesting about him is he served under Haines and Rumsfeld in the Defense Department when, of course, they were laying out all of their torture program, the so-called 15 Rumsfeld steps to torture. and he is also the architect of the original military commissions that were struck down by the Supreme Court. This is the man who President Obama has now put in charge of detainee policy. And by detainee policy, I mean people detained at Guantanamo, people detained at Bagram, people detained at prisons around the world. So you add Obama's statement in response to Palin, we're doing it just like they did. We're not just doing it like them. We're now appointing the people who did it for Bush. And not just Lightsoo, this colonel in charge of detainee policy, as we've talked to our listeners before. There's Steve Kappas, who is at the CIA, who is actually, many believe, in charge of the Makar Arar kidnapping that took place, that took him from here to be tortured in Syria, and one of the architects of the rendition program. And, of course, Brennan, who's a national security advisor to Obama, who was also beaten down from the CIA job originally because he was too involved in the terrorism policy.
What is Steve Kappas doing again?
I think he's the second person at the CIA. Counter-terror operations. And now he's been moved up to just under Panetta. So really, Kappas is probably running the CIA.
But Michael, the liberal constitutional protector, Greg Craig, he's there to help us, isn't he?
Oh, yes. Greg is there to help us. Right. He's out. Greg was the president's counsel. He also apparently fell on the sword of Guantanamo and anti-terrorism. I mean, Greg, who is he's not one of us, but apparently he took a stronger position on closing Guantanamo, ending military commissions, than the administration was willing to take. And he got beaten back by essentially probably the Gateses of the world, the Defense Department, which is, of course, the same Defense Department, the same Gates that was – it's not a different Gate. The same guy who ran it under Bush.
So Obama threw him under the bus. It's getting pretty crowded under the bus.
Well, so it doesn't look good on what I would call, what we've talked about many times here, the national security policies of the United States. Of course, the idea that we're going to close Guantanamo is 1 year. That 1 year is long past, and it seems to be just out the window. So we're not in good shape on these so-called national security policies. The Center for Constitutional Rights has for many years been litigating the issue of material aid to terrorism, whatever, and trying to hold different sections of the statute unconstitutional. For example, can you teach people the Geneva Conventions, and should that be considered aiding terrorism? And we've been litigating for a long time. We've been back and forth to various courts, and we have an argument coming up in a couple of weeks. I think, what's the date, March 27th, Heidi?
It's the 23rd.
March 23rd in the Supreme Court. It's a Center for Constitutional Rights case, and it's called Humanitarian Law Project because the Humanitarian Law Project purpose of that organization was to actually train people, whatever their political ilk, in how to obey the Geneva Conventions. Seems like a good idea. But what's going to happen in this case? What's this case, Heidi?
Well, this is actually a critical case because it's the first time the Supreme Court is going to hear a challenge to the portions of the USA Patriot Act that penalize the provision of material support. And that's broadly defined so that the argument is that it's unconstitutional, these portions of the act, because it can criminalize things like providing food, assistance to organizations through, as this humanitarian law project is doing, that we don't believe are criminal.
Any kind of assistance, as far as I know, even teaching them the Geneva Conventions.
Exactly. So David Cole will be arguing the case on behalf of CCR. We've had him on the show, one of the foremost constitutional scholars in the country. It should be, I think, a really important case, and I'm going to be down there for the argument, so I'm looking forward to it.
Well, great, Heidi. Well, wish us luck in the case. Wish David and the center luck.
We do.
And we'll see if we can hold on to anything in this court that is moving even more toward Attila the Hun than it was before.
Can you believe that the Simon Wiesenthal Center out in L.A., in connection with the Israeli government, is building a museum on a Muslim cemetery in Jerusalem? And the museum is going to be called the Museum of Tolerance. The Mamilla Cemetery is at least 800 years old, having in it 12,000 remains of soldiers who fought with Saladin against the Crusaders. In fact, the cemetery may even be older. Some think that followers of the Prophet Muhammad from the 7th century are buried there. Moreover, the cemetery contains the remains of important scholars and Muslim clerics and families from Jerusalem going all the way back at least 800 years. Today, we get an update on the legal battle because the Center for Constitutional Rights has filed a petition with the United States, an update on the legal battle surrounding this Simon Wiesenthal Museum of Tolerance project. We're joined by Palestinian-American lawyer Dima Khalidi. Dima is based in Chicago. She's got a J.D. from DePaul University College of Law and a master's from the School of Oriental and African Studies. She also went to the University of London, where she got a degree in international and comparative law with a focus on Islamic law. She has worked with the People's Law Office in Chicago and now with the Center for Constitutional Rights in bringing this petition to the United Nations. Dima, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Full truth here, Michael Ratner and I have been working with you and a team of lawyers on the petition that was filed last week with the United Nations about the Mimila Cemetery. And you were one of the people mainly responsible for drafting this really quite magnificent 80-some page document. Tell us about the Mimila Cemetery. Why is it important?
Well, the Mimila Cemetery is actually a huge piece of land located in West Jerusalem, and it's an ancient Muslim cemetery dating back at least to the 12th century, possibly even to the 7th century. We know that there are thousands of Salah ad-Din soldiers buried there and officials from that period, from the Crusader period of history, until 1948 when Israel seized control of West Jerusalem. Palestinian families have been burying their relatives there, or buried their relatives there until 1948 at least. It's a large cemetery, one of the oldest, certainly in Jerusalem and probably in all of Palestine. And it has the ancestors of the most biggest and most prominent Jerusalem families there, including my own family. So this issue is particularly close to me because I have ancestors buried there as well.
What's happening right now? I mean, the cemetery's there. It was originally 33 acres. I know it's been cut way down. But Simon Wiesenthal Center is planning to build something on it?
That's right. There has been a plan in the making for over a decade to build this so-called Center for Human Dignity Museum of Tolerance on top of the cemetery. The cemetery has been progressively built upon by Israel since the 50s, 60s. Right now, the historic area of the cemetery has a park on it. It has several buildings already built on top of it. And there was a car park built on the site where the Simon Wiesenthal Center is planning to build this museum. They have dug up layers and layers of human bones in the process of building this museum. Our petition to several UN bodies is really part of a larger history of opposition to these progressive encroachments on the cemetery. Palestinians and Jordanians, when they were in control of the West Bank, all were part of various efforts to stop these different encroachments on the cemetery, ultimately to no avail. So we hope that this time we will have some kind of influence on Israel, put some pressure on Israel and the Simon Wiesenthal Center to reconsider this grave desecration of this historic cemetery, which is really a big cultural heritage site. It's historically and religiously important to a number of Jerusalem families, all Muslims, and a lot of Jews and Israelis who have also protested.
I understand that Israel's Supreme Court ruled to go ahead with the construction, and in part because, as you mentioned, there have been other infrastructure, such as the parking lot, built on it. But can you give us a brief synopsis of the procedural history in court? Where are we? When did this first become a court matter?
There was an attempt in 2006 to bring this issue before the Supreme Court. In fact, the construction was stopped for a couple of years while the case was pending. And in 2008, the Supreme Court ruled that building on the cemetery was legal. This decision was based on a couple of false assumptions, really. The first being that there was no protest to, you know, the building of the car park in the 60s, which, as I mentioned, is not true. There were, in fact, protests by Palestinians when that car park was being built. The second assumption was that the area of the cemetery where this museum was being built was really not replete with human bones. This has proven to be false by the chief archaeologist appointed by the Israeli Antiquities Authority, which was digging the site of the museum, who attested that, in fact, there were four layers of burials dating back, the oldest dating back to the 11th century, and also that they themselves had excavated several hundred human remains, and that at least 2,000 human remains were still under the site of the museum.
Yeah, that's quite an important point, that their own archaeologist came out with the truth, so they buried that guy.
Their archaeologist called it an archaeological crime.
Archaeological crime.
Which is incredible, and of course the Supreme Court of Israel just ignored it, and as Dima pointed out, he said there's 2,000 people buried under here. And, you know, I think one difference, Dima, that you're bringing out is when they did the parking lot, apart from the protests, the parking lot was very bad, but at least the parking lot went over the cemetery.
That's
what
right.
Simon Wiesenthal Center is now doing, the so-called center for, I'm going to call it not so-called, now it's, we can call it the Center for Intolerance, I think is the right way to call it.
And indignity.
It says, right, that's actually better even. But it actually dug down into at least a couple of layers, if not more. We don't know, because we don't even know what happened to the bodies they took out.
Several hundred. But, you know, I wanted to underscore what you said, Dima, about this isn't just a Palestinian issue. It's a Jewish issue also, and there's been a lot of support from Jews. The mayor of Jerusalem offered a different site. The speaker of the Knesset, which is the parliament in Israel, the rabbinical council in Israel. And this is something I think that's going to catch on here in the United States, too, because there are a lot of people that realize that this is the kind of thing that can only build anti-Semitism and hatred.
Right. This is in addition to a number of American, U.S.-based Jewish groups and rabbis as well who have noted that not only are Jews opposed to this kind of desecration of their own people, but it's morally wrong to do that to the graves of others, and that, you know, this would not be tolerated if it were an ancient Jewish cemetery.
Well, what's the statistics with the Israelis have interceded 136 times in the last year when Jewish bones have been spotted? And how many times have they interceded in Muslim events? Zero.
I think what you're referring to is the fact that Israel has registered 136 Jewish holy sites in Israel, and it has not registered any Muslim or Christian sites to be as cultural heritage sites to be protected. So, you know, this is actually an indication of the kind of the discriminatory way that Israel treats its religious minorities. And in fact, you know, there's a lot of evidence of the way that Israel treats Muslim cemeteries all over Israel. This is not just about the Memilla Cemetery. Israel consistently digs up Muslim cemeteries in order to build roads, and, you know, they've been turned into garbage dumps. They're continually desecrated, and this case is not, you know, by itself. It's kind of part of a larger pattern of Israel's treatment of.
I'm glad you said that, Dima, because it's a larger pattern about cemeteries, and I remember visiting Hebron just a few weeks ago, and of course that cemetery is desecrated.
Mm-hmm.
But it also, in my mind, is, you know, they not only expel Palestinians from East Jerusalem, from the West Bank, from Israel itself, but they want to obliterate the memory of Muslims in Israel or Palestinians in Israel, and one way they do that is they pave over these cemeteries.
That's right. It's small symbols of this attempt to erase the Palestinian presence. I mean, I think this case is really emblematic of that. There's no better way to show people's attachment to the land and history in a land than an ancient cemetery dating back hundreds of years that, in fact, houses the remains of some of the most important figures in Jerusalem's history. So, you know, I think this case is really emblematic of that Israeli policy to erase the Palestinian presence, both in Israel and, of course, in the occupied territories, including East Jerusalem. They are trying to take off Arabic off the road signs. And, yeah, I mean, little things like this, they're all part of this larger effort.
Now, Dima, in fact, I've heard that the actual design of what the structure would look like if it were to be built is a very futuristic sort of glass, titanium, stone, kind of a symbol of American imperialism.
Yeah, actually, the design you speak of was Frank Gehry's design, and he has actually withdrawn from the project. He states that it's not because of any political reasons or any pressure about the desecration being committed, but there are indications that that might be the case. In any case, the museum project has allegedly been reduced, so we don't know what the design will be now, but certainly Frank Gehry's design was this very garish and imposing structure that would have really altered the landscape of West Jerusalem, and certainly would have led, I think, to the complete obliteration of the cemetery eventually.
Well, Dima, you're part of a really good legal team.
Indeed, thanks to you all.
Well, with Michael Ratner's on the team from the center, Maria LaHood, Len Wineglass, Richard Levy.
And Michael Smith.
And me.
And Richard Levy, oh, you said Richard.
Yeah.
But Dima did the yeoman work here, really.
And my question is, you've taken this to several bodies of the United Nations. What relief are you asking for, and how can our listeners help in publicizing what can only be called a real atrocity?
Well, we have gone to UNESCO, Human Rights Commission, and a couple UN special rapporteurs, including the Rapporteur on Freedom of Religion and Belief and the Rapporteur on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination and Other Forms of Intolerance. So what we're asking is that these bodies do several things. The first is to label this site as a historic site to be protected. The second is to pressure Israel to move this project off of the cemetery. The third is really to find out what's happened to all the remains that have been dug up in order that they be reburied by the Palestinian families, the petitioners, and other Muslim authorities in the cemetery where they were in the same location.
Yeah, that's always been amazing to me. You know, there was someone, I guess, who snapped a cell phone picture you put in the petition of the bones in like a cardboard box, right?
Right.
And yet it says in the petition, not yet, but it says in the petition, as you pointed out, what happened? There were 250, at least we know, according to the archaeologist, 250 sets of bones removed. Where are they? Were they thrown out?
Only in one part of this project. So there were several phases. The first phase was actual construction by a construction company, and they dug up hundreds of bones. And the archaeologists dug up another several hundred. And since the Supreme Court decision in 2008, we don't know how many, really, because this has all been done with a lot of secrecy and behind barriers and cameras. And we are trying to find out how many bones have been dug up, where they've been put. We don't know any of this information. And this is part of what we would like to find out with this petition, to urge these UN bodies to help us investigate this matter.
You know, one thing that always gets me, Dima, here, when you read the website of the Simon Wiesenthal Center,
they call themselves the Holocaust industry.
Right. They say they're there to combat anti-Semitism. And you would think from every point of view, from a logical point of view, from a moral point of view, from an ethical, from a legal, that if you want to combat anti-Semitism, you don't want to put a so-called Center for Tolerance on top of a Muslim graveyard. You don't get it. So you have to say to yourself, what else is really going on here? And it's what we've sort of said on this show, and we've said over time, what's going on here is essentially the expulsion of both the people and the memory of Muslims and Palestinians from Jerusalem. And because otherwise, it's nonsensical. What are they doing here?
What's the term?
Are they out of their minds?
Ethnocide. Isn't that called that the right term?
Anyway, what do you think about that, Dima?
I think you're right. It's completely hypocritical and incredibly, it's shocking, really, that they claim to be a center for human rights and human dignity, and at the same time they completely undermine the fact that Muslims and Palestinians and others are really offended by their move to build the cemetery and desecrate hundreds and hundreds of human remains. You know, they've called this kind of a political campaign to take over West Jerusalem. I mean, I think it's not a stretch to say that anybody would be offended by this kind of treatment of their ancestors and of any graveyard cemetery, really. The Simon Wiesenthal Center has been pushing against this kind of desecration of cemeteries in South America, of Jewish cemeteries in South America, and they've been pushing for the similar kind of respect we're asking for other Jewish cemeteries in Palestine and elsewhere. So it does seem very hypocritical and unfair, really.
Dima, what kinds of protests are being planned around this?
Well, today was the official submission of this petition, and we're hoping that it will generate some activities, actions around the U.S. We hope that some activities will be occurring on U.S. campuses. Really, we want to pressure the Israeli government as well as the Simon Wiesenthal Center, who's backing this financially, of course. And
absolutely, Dimi. Are you aware that Arnold Schwarzenegger, the governor of California, is a big financial contributor to the Simon Wiesenthal Center,
right,
as is Dianne Feinstein, the senator out there? Schwarzenegger came to the groundbreaking. Write him a letter. Write Feinstein a letter. Go on the web to the mamillacampaign.org. I'll repeat that, mamillacampaign.org, and you can get the petition and find out what we're doing. I know in New York, we've got activities planned at the various law schools up and down the Hudson Valley and the city and the tri-state area. Mamillacampaign.org to check in on that. Dima, I think that this is a campaign that we can win. I agree with you. That is so utterly shocking that there'll be an outrage across the board in all religions. Anybody that learns about this, you know, the great Rabbi Hillel from the 12th century was asked if he could sum up all of Jewish teaching while standing on one foot. And he said, yes. He said, don't do unto others what you wouldn't want done to yourself. And that's what's exactly going on here. And I think people understand that.
That's right. I would like to be as optimistic as you, but the Supreme Court just handed down another decision in December 2009 that basically affirmed its last decision that it was legal to build this museum on top of the cemetery. So not only has the Supreme Court weighed down twice on this matter, but, you know, the Simon Wiesenthal Center has been steadfast in its resolve to continue building this despite the mounting pressure. And so I hope that we can have an effect on them. And I really hope that the UN bodies to which we are appealing will take this seriously and investigate the matter and pressure Israel to do something about it as well.
Well, Chicago attorney Dima Khalidi, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. And everybody within earshot, mamillacampaign.org. That's Mamilla, M-A-M-I-L-L-A, mamillacampaign.org. Join us in this campaign. Thanks, Dima. Thanks for your good work.
Thank you,
thanks,
Dima. You did a great job. Congratulations.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Smith from the Dustbusters, and you're listening to Law and Disorder. If you like this kind of old folk music, check out Down Home Radio at downhomeradioshow.com.
Well, we're delighted, John, to welcome you back to Law and Disorder, and you've also helped us on these fundraisers in the past, so that's an extra special thanks. We're going to talk about your latest book, The Iraq Papers, and we're just thrilled to have you with us.
It's a pleasure to be here, as always.
It's always that. You, I have to say, John, you are our top most favorite guest on this show, and I'm glad to see you. And you're here with The Iraq Papers. Nice job. A 656-page book. It addresses every aspect of the conflict, from the military's evolving counterinsurgency strategy to declarations by Iraqi resistors, political figures from Coalition Provisional Authority. Rumsfeld talks about the economics of petroleum, the legal and ethical questions surrounding terrorism and torture, international agreements, the theory of the unitary president. It talks about the ideological path to war. I want to hear about that. The nature of the insurgency over there, U.S. oil policy, the legal road to torture. I think that Iraq was really a turning point in the American empire. And to have this book, I remember back when somebody did this book, Marvin Gettleman, I think, on Vietnam, which was another turning point. And now we've had this genocidal attack on Iraq, this pouring out of the American treasury on Iraq, even as this country is falling apart.
Why is it important now? We're sitting there with worrying about Afghanistan. What's this book?
All right, look, first of all, a couple of things. The book was done with four of us. It was three of my colleagues and me from the political science department at LIU in Brooklyn. And we did it actually, it's funny, Michael, that you mentioned Marv's book, because we did it largely because of Marv's book. Marvin's book, which is the Vietnam Reader and has now become the standard source for any information, any document you want about the Vietnam War, has gone through, I think, something like 18 printings. I know Marv. He's a friend of mine. The book has taken on a life of its own since 1965 when it first appeared. But when it first appeared, it was only 90-some-odd pages. And it's gotten bigger and bigger and bigger since then. And it was a tremendous resource to those of us who wanted to learn something about Vietnam in the early days of the conflict, since neither the media nor academia nor scholars were telling us anything that would be of use to us. So Marv's book was really essential. When we began thinking about doing this book, we did it with Marv's book as a model. We try to be fair, and I think we are fair. You know, I think we really do present many different voices about the Iraq War. At the same time, we felt it obligatory as citizens and as scholars to let our positions be known.
What lessons did you learn from writing this book, from putting this book together, and why is it important now?
I think the major lesson, we really approached this book as kind of old-fashioned citizens. The run-up to the war and the conduct of the war was so marked by misinformation, duplicity, lies, silence, from everybody, by the way, not just from the Bush administration, but everybody's hands are dirty in this, which is one reason why you're not finding the Obama administration really pressing the issue with regard to John Yoo or any kind of serious investigations of what led up to the war. Across the board, from official political policymakers to the media to almost everybody else, the public was deprived of adequate information about this conflict. And because it was deprived of that, and because the war was hyped up in an atmosphere of terror and hysteria and whatnot, we didn't have a fair debate about the war going into it. So in that really old-fashioned sense, we want this thing to be out there so that this kind of event doesn't happen again.
John, I just wanted to mention, the Library Journal says this is an excellent tool for college professors. And I note that you and the other editors are all academicians.
A lot of the documents are in the public domain. Others we had to get permissions for, but most people were pretty good about it. Most people really were perfectly willing to have their stuff out there.
And did you intend it to be something that could be used in the schoolroom?
Yes, we did. The major audience is people teaching courses, but it's really we really hope it's used by journalists, by researchers, by scholars of different kinds.
John, what you said initially really struck me, and I think we have to talk about this. You talked about the planning for this war going back to 1993. That was 10 years before the war started. What are we talking about here?
You know, a lot of people ask, why did the United States attack and invade Iraq? We debated this a lot because there are lots of different forces in play here, and there are lots of different balls in the air. You could talk about the role of the Israeli lobby. You could talk about Bush's attitude and relationship with his father. You could talk about the role of petroleum. You could talk about a lot of different things. Many of those things were factors in the war. But as we debated, we really came to the position that there's one single variable that really could be used to describe this war. With the fall of the Soviet Union in the late 1980s and early 1990s, there arose in Washington a group of intellectuals and analysts and observers, old Washington hands, these were not outsiders, who decided on the basis of considerable thought and evidence that the world had passed from a bipolar system in which there were two poles of power in the world, the United States and its allies and the Soviet Union and its, to a unipolar system with the collapse of the Soviet Union. These people became consolidated in a bunch of different groupings, the most important of which became known to us as the Project for the New American Century, and we call them the neoconservatives. Their view was that history had presented the United States with a unique moment to cement its hegemony over the entire world. I mean, it's really as simple and as breathtaking and as scary as that. And they, by the way, they were very clear about all this. They said it publicly. They published it on their website. You can find all the information out there. And their line was a simple one. From Charles Krauthammer to William Crystal to a lot of the intellectuals surrounding these guys. And by the way, they're still around.
This John, book, before you continue, I want to remind people, we're talking to John Ehrenberg. He's one of the editors of the Iraq Papers, a critical documentation of how we got into the Iraq War and why we're still there. Isn't Iraq gone? Isn't it passé? I know we care about how we got into it and how to cure that in the future. But of course, you know, we have books on how we got into Vietnam and how to cure that, and it never cured us. Is this going to bring us up to date in Iraq? Is it going to tell us what's going on, how we privatized it, what's going to happen there, and how many years is it going to be, and is it forever?
Saddam Hussein and Iraq were the poster children for the new American century. If you're looking for the single most important reason why we think the United States attacked and invaded Iraq, this was going to be the demonstration case for a world in which unchallenged American military and economic power could be brought to bear to organize the world according to liberal democracy, American style, free markets, and American military power and supremacy. Why care about it now? Well, for a lot of reasons. One of the debates the editors had as we went through this was how unique was the Bush administration? Or to what extent did the foreign policy of unilateralism and preemption simply mirror longstanding trends in American foreign policy? And we kind of split the middle. We decided both were true. This was a particularly clear administration. And if you look at the people who signed the original position papers for the Project for the New American Century, they go into the State Department and to the Defense Department in particular. So the Bush administration becomes a neoconservative administration. So on the one hand, you have a particularly clear point of view articulated in Washington that later becomes sharpened and focused after 9/11, when they begin searching around for how to respond to this thing and how to use 9/11. In that sense, the Bush administration was unique. On the other hand, the invasion and the occupation of Iraq continue a long trend of unilateralism and military adventurism in American foreign policy, and that's not gone away, and there's no reason to expect that even with a new administration, somehow you're seeing a more pacific, benign U.S. foreign policy. That's one piece of it. The other piece of it is that the neoconservatives haven't disappeared. They're still out there. Every couple of weeks, Dick Cheney gets on the newspaper, gets on the television, and attacks Obama for something or other, and that gets trumpeted by Fox. They're all over Sarah Palin. Not only does the Iraq War illustrate longstanding trends in U.S. foreign policy, but in a more particular way, the architects of the war, the ideological reasons for it, et cetera, are still alive and kicking, and we got to be aware of it.
John Ehrenberg, one of the co-editors of the Iraq Papers. John's one of our favorite guests on Law and Disorder. He and the other co-editors have come out with a new book, an important book called The Iraq Papers. We had the same phenomena years ago with Vietnam, and John has replicated this. They went from Iraq after destroying that place, killing over a million people, and we all know what they did there, but now they're in Afghanistan. Doesn't that show that there are really forces at play in American elites, that whether it's the Republicans in Iraq or the Democrats in Afghanistan, what underlies this foreign policy? You talked about the ideology of making the world a unipolar place, but continue that thought, will you? Because that's what I think. What's the story with Afghanistan? Is it a continuation of the Bush policy in Iraq?
Yeah, in some ways it is. Look, these are long trends. And ever since the United States evolved and emerged as a world power in the late 19th century, there's been this commitment on the part of American political and military and economic elites that was organized around a claim that expansion and internationalism was key to domestic prosperity and domestic democracy. That's a long-standing trend in American foreign policy. When you link that up with the particulars of this particular moment in history, you've got Iraq, you've got Afghanistan, you've got whatever happens tomorrow. There was a very good piece that Gary Wills wrote in the New York Review of Books about 2 months ago. It's called Embattled Giant or something like that. I think it's Embattled Giant. It says, look, it doesn't matter how reformist this or that president is when he or she comes into power. It doesn't matter how determined this or that president is to unravel some of the military misadventures of previous administrations. Any president who comes into power is confronted by, and Wills doesn't use this phrase, but I'm going to, by what continental European philosophers are now calling the deep state. That is to say, the state apparatus and the institutions and the commitments and the understandings that are deep beneath the surface and that are immune to democratic pressure and that are not touched by elections or anything else. What Will says is that, and he's using Obama as an example, he says, look, this guy comes into power and he's immediate. It doesn't matter what he believed. We actually know that his beliefs are not diametrically or radically different from those of Bush, but let's say that he was. Coming into power, he is confronted with a mass of secret treaties, foreign obligations, understandings, military entanglements, hundreds of bases and hundreds of countries. And assuming that he was really an honest anti-imperialist, even if he were, he would be unable to disentangle himself from that apparatus.
It's a good piece. He bases too much on the bomb and the national security state that happened as a result of the bomb. And the critique I would have is that, as you pointed out, it's a much longer-term trend. Yeah. And when after I read the piece, I said Obama's like a small person on the top of a whale of a national security state, or as you say, the deeper state. But on the other hand, I do think even within the what you would call the inelastic boundaries of an imperialist country, there's a lot more he could have done.
Absolutely.
And so that's why I don't want people to think that he's just his hands are tied like some giant up there. They aren't. That there is a lot more. We can see that whether it's on the preventive detention or you can see it on Afghanistan and the troop increase.
I think Afghanistan is at least in part designed to protect himself from the right on charges of abandoning Iraq. So that's one piece of it. I think the other piece is that they know that this thing in Afghanistan is an absolute catastrophe. And the way I think about this thing, I think about it in terms of Kissinger's delightful line about Vietnam, that Vietnamization in Vietnam was designed to purchase what Kissinger called a decent interval during which the United States could prepare public opinion and get out. I don't think these Obama people are under any illusions that they can do in Afghanistan what nobody has ever been able to do for all of recorded history. I think that this is basically a holding operation. It's designed to provide them with some cover. And within 4 or 5 years, you're going to start to see a withdrawal. And what happens next, who knows?
So sad to me, you know, if that's really the truth, because
that's
what
it's
doing is destroying the people in Afghanistan and the structures of Afghanistan, as well as killing Americans. So I've heard that it's, you know, the political cover and to win the next election and all that. Whether I accept that, I don't know, but it's certainly a pretty sad comment.
Could you tell us a bit about your co-editors? I see that J. Patrice McSherry has written Predatory States, Operation Condor. Have you worked together for a while?
We have. All four of us are in the poli-sci department at LIU. And it just so happens that we have very complementary interests in this thing. So Patrice McSherry is a Latin Americanist. She knows about the history of U.S. imperialism in that part of the world. She's also she does a lot of work on human rights, torture regimes, predatory states, state violence, and terrorism. She made a lot of contributions in terms of the history of U.S. foreign policy, the notion, as I said before, that this thing in the Middle East and Iraq was not unique to that part of the world. We have some great documents that Patty supplied, including one called the Kubark. It's a CIA manual that became declassified a few years ago that basically outlines waterboarding and all of the torture techniques that were applied in Iraq. This was something that was developed, I think, in the 1950s.
We call it the Bad Apple Manual.
The Bad Apple Manual.
It's a joke, of course, because they aren't bad apples. They have a manual.
That's right. So when we say things like the Iraq thing was only the culmination of years of U.S. foreign policy, we've got the documents to prove it. Jose Sanchez is a specialist in American democratic political theory, American democratic institutions, and he also got very interested in the whole petroleum thing. So the oil chapter is his. Jose discovered this dynamite document that was produced by two guys, I think in the late 1990s, from the National War College, that is the theoretical origin of the shock and awe doctrine.
Ah.
And by the way, it's the first and only reader of its kind out there, which is really astonishing. Oxford University Press brought it out, and it is amazing that here, X number of years later, there is no general reader except ours. Jose's document that he found about the shock and awe doctrine basically says that the idea about shock and awe is twofold. When they talk about shocking a society, they're not talking about simply shocking the Iraqi army. They were talking about shocking the entire society with a full-fledged assault on infrastructure, on means of communication, on electricity, on the oil, on the delivery of oil. The first piece of it is that this is very close to, if not over, the line separating war crimes from decent legal activity in war. The second thing is that they also talk about shocking opinion here at home, about paralyzing the opposition with the ferocity of an American assault. Political scientists use the term demonstration effect. And the closest example, and I'm using this example in full knowledge of the implications, the historical example that we always use is the German role during the Spanish Civil War. When the Nazis brought forward all of their high-powered, high-tech apparatus at the time. And when people ask about Guernica and the high, you know, the saturation bombings and the strategic stuff that the Germans deployed in Spain, it always seems that it was too much, that it was over the top. But it wasn't, because the audience for what the Germans were doing in Spain wasn't the Spanish Republicans. The audience was the military attachés and the diplomats from other countries. This is what we will do to you if you mess with us. That's what we call the demonstration effect. The attack and the invasion and the occupation of Iraq, the whole shock and awe strategy, was a demonstration effect. And it was aimed as much at people like the Chinese and the Russians as it was at the Iraqis themselves. This is what the world can expect to find in the era of the new American century. Caroline Sayedge is a young political scientist, which was nice also because Jose and Patty and I are in our 50s and sometimes our 60s, and Caroline is in her 30s, so she's a kid. So she, not only is she a kid, but she also brought a lot of modern social science and political science techniques and methods and whatnot to the project and greatly strengthened it. She's a specialist in the politics of the Middle East. So she knew about the history of U.S. foreign policy in the region. She knew about the Iran-Iraq war. She knows about a lot about the political theory and theology of Islam. We have some documents that she translated that are fatwas and other statements from Iraqi political and religious leaders that give you a sense of how rich and deep the level of discussion in Iraq was. This was a highly, before the United States destroyed it, this was a highly civilized society with a tremendous degree of debate and discussion about the proper role of religion, the role of force, the role of the conflicting demands of being a citizen of a secular nation versus being a Shiite, for example. Caroline found and translated a bunch of documents that give you a sense, and that's all the book does, is it gives you a sense of things, because the Iraq war is a lot bigger than we could capture in the book. Some of her stuff is really suggestive of a very, very rich nationalist, anti-imperialist discourse in that part of the world that not only did not go away, but is alive and well in Iraq now. So when I say that this book was written yesterday, it really was. All of the trends that we illustrate in the book, and the book does end with Obama's election. It's a book about the Bush administration. But in the months since then, every time a story comes out in the paper about some new development in the Iraq war, you know, we email each other, call each other and say, it's in the book. We said that. It's there. And indeed, it really is. So nothing that's happened in the war has yet confounded our analysis. The reader is designed to give people a basic orientation about what happened during the attack and the invasion and the occupation of Iraq, and also to stimulate them to further debate and discussion on their own.
Professor John Ehrenberg, chairman of the Department of Political Science at Long Island University, he and three others have edited the Iraq Papers, a great basic book for everybody who wants to oppose the war in Iraq and its cousin, the war in Afghanistan, and to understand the forces behind U.S. foreign policy. Law and Disorder. Michael and Heidi and I are lawyers. This program is mostly about law, public policy. This book, I imagine, is about law. The war in Iraq? Was it legal? The legal road to torture, was that legal? Talk to us about what's in the book about those two things.
We've got a lot of stuff about that. We've also got a lot of stuff about the theory of the unitary presidency, the role of the OLC and of John Yoo and all these guys. The basic orientation of the Bush foreign policy was organized around what we call preemption. These guys were absolutely explicit and clear in what they said. That's, the astounding thing about that is that they announced their intentions years before. So none of this should have come as a surprise to people. None of this should have come as some kind of shock to people, because everything that the Bush administration put into motion was on paper, on the internet, in public policy documents written by the same people who became the Secretary of Defense and the Vice President and the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Affairs and et cetera, et cetera. So when we talk about the road to torture, or when we talk about the road to the so-called unitary presidency and the use of signing documents, signing statements rather, and the notion that the president can overrule not just acts of Congress but decisions of courts, when you talk about all of these things, the orientation of the United States toward its foreign commitments, toward its foreign treaties which it had signed and to which it was legally obligated to adhere, the Bush administration was literally a lawless administration. That is to say, its claim was power trumps everything. We will abide by those laws that we choose to abide by, and we'll ignore those laws which we find inconvenient. We will agree to continue our treaty obligations with regard to those treaties we find convenient, and we will discard those we don't. Not only did they take a position they would discard or ignore treaty obligations and domestic laws, they actually said we will do that which we want to do even if they are in violation of domestic law and international treaty obligations. This was an administration whose basic position was might makes right.
So here's a question for you. Look, now we're in a new administration. And now what I see, at least from my work, certainly with Guantanamo, is they want to just put a little legal framework on the thing to make it look a little more legitimate. But in fact, of course, now they're doing under, quote, law, roughly, and it even is said in the New York Times today, that even the Bush administration says on national security, we're doing the same thing the Bush administration is. So how come we're getting beat up by the Republicans now when we're doing the same things you guys were doing? And they actually say that.
That's right.
And so they're clothing themselves in a little more law, which is what I sort of expected. I remember writing a piece, you know, don't repackage Guantanamo. Of course, that's what they've done. What's happening in Iraq now? How is this book going to help us figure that out? But this is sort of becoming what Afghanistan was, you know, 2 years ago, the war that no one really seemed to focus on.
What we say in the book, and it was kind of interesting, Michael, because one of the debates we had as the book was winding down is we had to decide how we felt about the surge, about Bush's surge. What we came to
is the surge in Iraq.
The surge in Iraq, yeah. And the reason I mention that is it's not unlike Obama's surge in Afghanistan. The Bush surge in Iraq was designed to purchase and to buy time. And to allow a decent interval during which the United States could prepare world and domestic opinion for an American withdrawal. In that sense, militarily speaking, the surge, quote unquote, worked in Iraq. It tamped down the level of violence. It got the Sunnis involved in supporting the government. It divided the opposition. It did what it was, quote unquote, supposed to do. It didn't go anywhere towards solving the deeper underlying political problems. And this was a common complaint that you heard at the time, and it's turned out to be true, because all of the political issues that are on the table today, who are legitimate actors in the Iraq election that's coming up? What about Kurdistan? What about the division of oil revenues? What about the relationship between provinces and the center? All of these fundamental political issues that any society has to solve before it can move forward remain unresolved in Iraq. I think you've got a similar situation, although on a lower level, in Afghanistan. Afghanistan's a different – when I say lower level, I mean that Afghanistan is a less organized society. And so the nature of the problems are much more basic and fundamental in Afghanistan than they were in Iraq. But you've got the same kind of situation. You've got Obama's surge, which is designed to provide a decent interval during which the United States can set the pieces in motion for the American version of Vietnamization. So they'll train some Afghani soldiers, and they'll try to get a functioning state apparatus going, and after 3 or 4 years, they'll get out. And what will happen 3 or 4 years from now is that the same political issues in Afghanistan will remain unresolved, just as they have been in Iraq, because you can't solve political issues militarily. That's the issue. And that is what the neocons were convinced they could do. With all of their power and all of their arrogance and all of their conviction and all of their self-righteousness that the time was at hand to organize the world around American power in a way that would benefit everybody. What's astonishing about the Bush people and the neocons is how badly they've messed it up. When American troops entered Baghdad, and all of a sudden there's this orgy of violence and looting, and within days, the entire society is starting to come undone. And people in the United States were sitting around scratching their heads saying, what's going on here? Did they not anticipate this stuff? Did they not have some sense that they would have to do something after occupying and shocking and awing the entire society? And you know something? The answer is they didn't. They really honestly believed what they said. When Rumsfeld, you know, it's almost like comedy now. When you read back and you listen to Rumsfeld talking about how they were going to greet us with, you know, with flowers and with candy and stuff like that. But I really believe these guys believe that. At the end of a brief and violent military campaign during which the American army occupies the entire country, within days, the entire thing is becoming undone. And the rest of it was simply a catch-up operation. The takeaway from this is the same takeaway that we took away in Vietnam. The application of military force and of overwhelming American violence can only go so far. If the conditions for American power are not there, and they weren't in Vietnam, and they aren't in Iraq, and they aren't in Afghanistan, then the thing is a lost project. So there, too, there's a continuity between these three post-war adventures. When you look at the history of the Iraq War, and you look at the people who planned it and organized it, these were not outsiders. These were not amateurs. These were not clowns.
That's
true. When you're looking at people like Wolfowitz, you look at the people who originally signed the statements from the Project for the New American Century. It's people like Paul Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld. These were Washington insiders. These were guys who, in some cases, have been serving American presidents since Gerald Ford.
Obviously, they're both disguises for imperial plunder.
Of course.
There's no question.
Of course. But
you're saying to me that they actually
believe
those
so.
Two stories. I think you may
and
be
by the
right,
way,
probably.
And it's yeah, not just them.
Matter.
It's right. Not just them. It's see, this is why all Americans need to read this book. Because this notion of American exceptionalism, this notion of the United States is God's gift to the world, this notion of the United States is better than anybody else, when married to a sclerotic public discourse and overwhelming power.
What word
power.
Was that?
Yeah, it was
an academic. Say that again.
Word.
This is something.
That's what your arteries are all clogged up in
this
your body.
This is one of those $10,000.
Sclerotic?
That sclerotic, I say.
Sclerotic. That's like my heart will be in about 40 years.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.